to the Past is Present podcast. This is the official podcast of Past is Present, a blog from the American Antiquarian Society. I'm Ashley Cataldo. Today we're talking with Denise Miller, who's just finishing up a Charlotte and Robert Barron Fellowship at the Society. Denise is a teacher, poet, activist, and chef who's based in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Her work has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize and also the American Book Award. Denise's current project is called Travelogos, African Americans and the Struggle for Safe Passage. Today we'll be chatting about her current work and also hear a few poems. Denise, I've heard you speak in the past.
Yes.
And I know that there is a poem that you like to cite before giving a talk or doing a poetry reading.
Yes.
Would you like to recite one for us today to get us started?
Hopefully I'll remember it. This is one that I do, and it's called Speakeasy. And it was, it kind of gets me back to the archives idea. So I was on sabbatical, and I started to think about my family and the family stories that I'd been told, and decided to do a little bit more research. And at the end of my research day at the Historical Society in my hometown, the person that was working with me said, "And so you know that your family owned a speakeasy." And I remember being in my aunt's house and everybody coming over and people playing cards and eating food. I didn't realize it was a speakeasy. And it's testament to the fact that my town was very segregated, even in my growing up. And so there were no African-American bars or places to, you know, collect together. So I was really struck by that. And so the poem that I did is called Speakeasy, and it has everything to do with the women in my family. So here goes. I come from a long line of speakeasy women, women with veins full of dandelion wine and Jesus. In her 20s, my great-grandmother got on her knees to clean white women's kitchens. She climbed ladders to vinegar shine their windows with the daily paper. At 50, my great aunt folded chicken into cornmeal and fried, and they all piled crispy legs and thighs neatly onto paper plates to serve for $5 to feed their children and their children's children. And I come from a long line of life ain't easy women. My great aunt, until she was struck almost speechless by stroke, filled pots as tall as three-year-old children with dandelions to make wine, and I would watch her lose herself in the music her hands made for hours. Scraping yellow petals from green stalks to soak in sugar till the sweet came out seemed to soothe her. Now, she was not a moonshine woman, nor did she stomp on grapes from sunup to sundown or pluck purple fruit from vineyards. No, see, her backyard was rock-heavy and full of weeds with soil so memory-laden that it was soaked with her dreams, because she was a speakeasy woman who made her living. She was bartender and cook and music of the juke joint her husband's mother started before she was born, while her husband prayed at girls pushed into womanhood by their father's hands just outside her view. And I come from a long line of deep-breathing women, women who measure sadness by the length of arm they can put between dirt and starched white sheets hung high on ribbed clothesline. See, they were all hardly loved by men that etched their brown skins with hands that held their cry suspended in moonlight. And I come from a long line of learning to love hard women, women who as black girls fought to find their reflection in the slip between the spit shine of society's funhouse mirrors and the shimmer of grown men's grins in the shadowed outlines of their bedroom doorways. See, I am speakeasy women, women who speak when it's not always easy women, women who word small brown girls into grown black sisters and cousins and mothers and aunts and grandmothers and great-grandmothers and great-great-grandmothers who learn to love themselves. These women who learn to love themselves hard. I'm used to doing that walking poem. Around. Thank you. I'm used to like walking around when I do that. That's sort of my performance poem. So sitting here and doing it is so hard. It was so hard.
I'm sorry.
No. I should have said that to you. I totally should have said that to you. But yeah, it was interesting. But
a little different experience.
Yeah, I got more self-conscious and I started to listen to myself, which I can't do when I have poems memorized. It's bad.
Yeah.
I memorize often just to lose myself in the poem, so I'm not so self-conscious on stage.
So was memorizing poems part of your education, or did you know?
No, not at all. So, because when I, that's not necessarily true. There wasn't really slam and spoken word poetry at that point, right? Mm-hmm. So when I did my undergrad, my BFA at Bowling Green State University, really great creative writing program with some really great professors. But the place where we really, there was one particular professor who really talked with us about speaking, saying our poems as if they mattered. So when we were workshopping, if we read our poem and we didn't say it mm-hmm. with enough conviction or like that people should care about it, mm-hmm. right? If we're sitting there whispering, then she's like, you gotta, you know, do it again, speak it as if it matters. So I think that was the place about being conscious that if I'm not in my poem, neither will other people be in my poem. And then the other piece I think is, and I just thought about this when you asked me that question, growing up, my great grandmother had a book of poems by Paul Laurence Dunbar. And I remember, and I think now thinking back, I think it was probably a rare book, you know, it was like a first printing, but I would carry it around like crazy. You know what I mean? Because it was just the first time I'd ever run across an African-American poet. And I remember just, you know, even thinking about that book now, I cried. And his poetry is very, like, When Melindy Sings is a poem that comes to my mind all the time. And so I think I memorized that of my own accord. And then I also memorized Still I Rise by Maya Angelou when I was young as well, because her collection of autobiographies is something, too, that I was able to see myself in. And my grandmother was a librarian, so I spent a lot of time in the library.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. My grandmother was a librarian and my grandfather was illiterate. So it's so, it's so interesting. Yeah. I write about that in my first book, Core.
I didn't know that that was...
Yeah, there's so
much... I don't
much...
remember that being part of the story.
Well, it's in... there are a series of three poems. There's a poem called Shudder, and then it's actually right up now, and there's a poem called Semantics, and then there's a poem called Origin Story. And it's hinted at in those poems because they had a very sort of difficult relationship.
Yeah.
And so that comes through in the poem I just did for you, Speakeasy. She's one of those women bruised by their husband's hands. Yeah. And so, it's in these poems, thinking part of his anger toward her was her sort of being not up on this pedestal, but having, being literate and having knowledge and being smarter than him. And then him, he was a mechanic and he was illiterate. And the other thing about him, though, he was a very violent person on the weekends, but he also grew flowers, the most beautiful flowers I've ever seen during the week. You know, I mean, he grew them all the time, but it was just so many sort of diasporate experiences. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. One of the, that was in some ways the reason that I wrote the first book was really looking at what blue collar work, I think, did to families and especially for people of color. And, you know, my dad talks about the difference between his experiences with when he would interview for the coal mining jobs as opposed to the white people that would interview. And they got to work above ground. And a lot of the black men had to work in really dangerous conditions underground. And so I know that that impacted what it was like when they came home and how they interacted with their wives and their girlfriends and their children. So.
So your grandmother was a librarian. So she had a large book collection in her home?
You know, she didn't, honestly. It's so odd. She spent a lot of time in the library. I think what she was most excited about in the library, honestly, she loved films. She would bring home, she brought home a film projector, you know, the reel-to-reels. And on almost every weekend, we would go to the basement and we would watch old films.
Oh, that's fun. Do you remember anything specific that you watched?
I remember, you know, I remember Wizard of Oz for sure. But I can't remember what else we watched, but it was, you know, it was a regular thing. I have to ask my sister.
And it was
just
the experience of being together as a family.
Oh, it was hugely experience. Yeah. And just seeing things come alive. And that experience kind of showed up in one of the poems that I wrote about her, one that was actually nominated for a Pushcart. And I was surprised because it seems to me that it was one of her escapes. And also it was a place of calm in that house because that house was not very calm. But she always encouraged us to read. You know, they had reading competitions. And of course, we had to look good and read as many books as we could because she was the librarian and we couldn't let her down. But we loved reading anyway, you know. So
So would you say she's the one who sort of initially got you into poetry and literature more generally? Or
Literature more generally. Oh, and microfiche and microfilm. Oh, my gosh. I think she's the first. Oh, yeah. That's when I was in high school and junior high, what
you
it was
had
called
an
then.
In.
I did. So I was using microfilm and microfiche doing research at that time. And so I think she gave me the research bug, definitely.
Okay.
And she gave me the bug of finding people that looked like me in literature. But she also, what I didn't know is in sixth grade, there was a fire at her house. And when we went to like sift through and see what we could recover, I found a little poetry book of hers. It was a little black book, you know, those little like notebooks that maybe journalists would keep. And it was a lot of really hard poetry.
Really?
Yeah, and I never talked to her about it. But I, and we, yeah, so, and like that was sixth grade, and my grandmother lived, and we were very close, and she lived until she, until I was, she lived until the year 2000, so I was well out of graduate school at that point.
Yeah.
But because it was such hard poetry, you know, about the things that she was going through with my grandfather, I didn't ever say anything about it. And I didn't realize that somewhere in there, she was the influence for me about writing poetry. But yeah, it's not anything.
Do you, I mean, I'm assuming you still have the book.
I don't. I put it back because I didn't want her to know that I had it. Okay. But I do have some of the poems. You know, I wrote some of them down.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they're, my sister actually has them in a chest. So, yeah.
What were the, I mean.
What were the contents?
Yeah. Well, what were they like? I mean, did she follow any, could you tell that she followed any models?
Or, absolutely. I mean, she, I mean, very much traditional iambic pentameter, you know, and and rhyme every other line. But the interesting thing is that she wrote, I would consider her, honestly, even though she wrote in that form, so I think she was, you know, as a librarian, she was pretty traditional in terms of what she was probably reading.
Right.
But it was revolutionary stuff. I mean, it was really like the stuff that a lot of the women, a lot of the black women writers of the 60s and 70s who were writing about difficult times. And so she was really doing a lot of that,
kind of,
yeah, that conversation, the same topics, but she was doing it sort of Phyllis Wheatley style. You know what I mean? Yeah. So.
And it sort of, I mean, there's a quotation, and pretty sure it's Langston Hughes, but he says something like, "We do not write down that which is most deeply felt."
Yes.
And so, I mean, this is private poetry that she wrote down, but it makes you wonder about all of the thoughts and feelings that, you know, women over, you know, throughout history who didn't have, or even your illiterate grandfather, who didn't have the capability of, you know, writing something down, but deeply feeling.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think that that's true. I mean, that's part of the project I'm working on now, right, here at the Society. I mean, we see that often when people, and even going back to the poems that I wrote in the first book, when people don't get a chance to say their side of a story, then we can write them and see them. When I say write them, I mean kind of create them, living and breathing any way we want to.
So can you talk a little bit about the project that you're working on here?
Yeah, definitely.
And how that has sort of changed in the time that you've been here, and how various types of research that you've done and materials that you've come across have altered the work.
Yeah, so the materials are spinning in my head right now, honestly, because I'm in that consumption mode, you know. I think
we should just say that this is at the tail end.
This is
of
yeah, I
the
leave
fellowship.
Tomorrow, yes. And I haven't. So okay, let me just say the first thing, which is I love to research, and my students know this, my friends know this. I could research more than I could write because I love it that much. I mean, I think it's such a revelatory experience and a transforming experience. But I started out the idea for the original project, which I haven't moved totally away from and or haven't left behind by any means, but it's about mobility. And it's about the idea of how Black people, whether they're African or African-American, the contrast between their opportunities or experiences with travel, physical travel, and European and European Americans. So, you know, we're going 16th, 17th, and 18th century, really, right? And really looking at the difference between the travel logs. So African Americans, for example, their travel logs tend to be runaway advertisements or, you know, looking in newspapers and looking in, and looking at letters, people saying, you know, well, my man who I was going to sell has just run away. So if you see him, make sure that you get him. And then I want you to sell him, you know. And that's in some of the manuscripts that I've been reading here at the Society. One of the beautiful things about the Society, one of many beautiful things, I have to say, this is the most amazing experience I've had with archives. And I've had other fellowships and other experiences with archives for a long time. And there's just so much good about what happens here, honestly. So anyway, one of the things that's beautiful about the collections here are the manuscript collections, I think. because you get a context. And you don't only get these snippets of, you know, he ran away, but I want to sell him, or I don't think you've, you know, given me enough money for this person. I could have sold them up north here for more money. So we really see these differences between the South and the North. Mm-hmm. And we see a lot about property. And so, but having started to research, what I was finding out, I ran across, as I was looking at this idea of mobility, I ran across the case of Elizabeth Freeman, or Mom Bet. And that experience really moved me. Initially, the story is a story of mobility or lack thereof for African Americans. You know, she sued for her freedom, and I don't know if I need to go into the deep. Okay, good.
Yeah,
okay.
So
she was born in Claverack, or either born or came there as a baby in Claverack, New York. And the Hogebooms, Peter Hogeboom and his wife, were the ones who claimed to own her. So she was there living with them. Presumably amongst other Africans as well. I mean, that was really early, so probably Africans, right? And when Hogeboom had a daughter named Hannah, and when Hogeboom died, he left his Negroes, both women and men, or male and female, to his daughter, Hannah. Before he died, she married John Ashley, who lived in Sheffield, Massachusetts. When they left Sheffield, or when they got married, they lived in Sheffield, and they also, it seems like they jumped over to Connecticut for a moment. I'm still kind of sorting that out. But documents show that they came back to Sheffield ultimately, and they brought Mom Bet, or they called her Bet at that point. I'm also interested in the way her name transitions. So she was Bet when she was young. And then she stayed with the Ashleys, and story has it that either her Bet's daughter or Bet's sister was also enslaved in the household, along with four other African-American men, or African men, not sure, probably African. And when there was one time in the kitchen where Hannah Ashley, now Ashley was Hogeboom, but Hannah Ashley, the mistress of the house, saw the young girl, not Bet, but the young girl, going to get some leftovers and food, and she got really angry, and she lifted the hot shovel that was in the big stove and raised it to hit the young girl. And Elizabeth, I'll use your name there at that moment, Bet, who ultimately is Elizabeth Freeman, lifts her arm and blocks the blow. And there's a cut in her arm that she leaves, and all the literature says she leaves it because she wants people to ask her what happened to her. And she wants to let them know that Hannah Ashley, or the mistress, did that. And so ultimately then she decides to sue for her freedom. And so she goes to Theodore Sedgwick, who's also living in Sheffield at that time, who's a lawyer, and so is John Ashley, by the way. But Theodore Sedgwick is a lawyer, and she goes to him and asks him to help her sue for her freedom. He does that. He sues, and there are two people on the suit, Brahm, who's also an enslaved person in the Ashley household, and then her, Bet. And they win their freedom suit. And the thing that's interesting about them, which really inspires me and made me want to take on this individual story and then yet again grow it differently, was the fact that she sued differently than other people had sued before her. Actually, 4 months before, another person sued John Ashley for abuse, an enslaved person in the household. And but he sued based on abuse. She sued based on the idea that she was a human being. And because the Massachusetts Constitution, if all people are free and I'm a person, then this should work for me too. So she wins. And now this is the mobility piece. Like I said, there were four other Africans enslaved in the household. And John Ashley asked her to come back and work for him for money. And she said no. She refused to go back. She's a midwife and a nurse, as well as a housemaid. And so she's able to have her mobility because other people are already going to be paying her to continue to be a midwife and a nurse. And so she goes and lives with the Sedgwicks, works for them, and then also continues to deliver babies in the community. But Brahm and the other four people who were enslaved didn't have any other skills except the ones that would still kind of keep them at the mercy of the Ashleys, right? Yeah. And so they go back. Eventually, all of them go back except Brahm and work for the Ashleys. Brahm supposedly might even have ended up going to prison and ultimately dying not long after prison. So that's a lot of the stuff I'm doing in terms of digging. But so that led me on first looking at Elizabeth Freeman. Mm-hmm. So when she's when she gets freed, mm-hmm. she name changes her name to Elizabeth Freeman. Mm-hmm. She lives in, with the Sedgwicks from probably 1781 when she sues, yep. maybe even earlier, until 1803.
Okay.
Yeah. And then she has her own home and mm-hmm. her, for sure, her grandchildren live with her for mm-hmm. a while. So looking at her and realizing that she is so visible in mm-hmm. Catherine Sedgwick's letters, and Catherine Sedgwick wrote a biography of her, a short biography, mm-hmm. but still disputing that she's still not sure if Mumbat, or mm-hmm. Elizabeth Freeman, excuse me, if Elizabeth Freeman had, if it was her daughter mm-hmm. that she almost got hit at the Ashleys, or if it was her sister. Mm-hmm. And no one seems to know who Elizabeth Freeman's husband mm-hmm. was. And for her to, for people to be around her so much and write so much about her and not, I would say not care, yeah. to be honest with yeah. you, because I'm certain that those people were around in her life, mm-hmm. but to not be sure if that yeah. was a daughter or a, so.
So what do you think, yes. you know, sort
why
of.
Why is that happening?
Yeah, why is that happening?
Yeah, and that's this next piece of yeah. what I'm going to. I'm going to this idea of hero, mm-hmm. right, or heroine. And I think that there are a lot of African-American women, a lot of Black women at this time, and I'm focusing on Black women for right mm-hmm. now, but I definitely can expand it for sure, because I'm thinking of The Heroic Slave by Frederick Douglass. Mm-hmm. I mean, Black people are being made either heroes or villains at this time, mm-hmm. right? And so they want to, everything that people are writing about with her are these heroic moments that she has, mm-hmm. the moment she blocks the shovel, the moment that she yeah. Stands up to the men in Shay's Rebellion to protect the Ashleys' mm-hmm. Possessions. So there are all of these heroic moments. Mm-hmm. The moment that she comforts Catherine Sedgwick when Catherine's mother dies, but nothing about her personally. And mm-hmm. so I think that, and the fact that they even name her Mumbat or Motherbat, that people are often looking at what Black people do to serve, or to do something sort of servant-like and heroic for white people. Mm-hmm. And so they're always going to be looking at the larger than life things that these people do. Mm-hmm. And what I think is important is, the danger in that is they're always moving people out of personhood, Black people out of personhood. So when they describe Elizabeth Freeman, mm-hmm. for example, when she stands up for that with a shovel, mm-hmm. Catherine Sedgwick says she was like a lioness protecting her cub. Mm-hmm. That's, again, dehumanization, mm-hmm. right? And I want to juxtapose that with the ways that people look at white heroes at this time. You mm-hmm. know, the ways that they describe
yeah.
George Washington. They don't use animal language, right. no matter what. It's right. usually, white people are usually like gods,
mm-hmm.
And Black people are like animals, mm-hmm. for good or for
repeated.
Bad. Yeah.
So actually, I'm curious, because you're talking about animals and
yeah.
and your poetry sort of interacts in very clear ways with the natural world.
Yeah.
How?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it's
yeah,
it,
yeah.
it really does. It come. I mean, just in looking at Core again, I mean, mm-hmm. you really see it come up again and again.
Right.
How do you sort of see the natural world as playing a role mm-hmm. in your work?
That's big. I have one of the historians that I admire mm-hmm. most is Dr. Michelle Johnson, who really got me shifting my language around mm-hmm. claim to own versus own. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to conferences with her and seeing the resistance of people saying, well, wow, that's a lot to have to say. Why do we have to say claim to own instead of own? And, you know, I mean, and so one of the things that she talked about, and as we're talking about my project right now, she said, okay, Denise, you're definitely writing about humanness, but what you're also doing then is relegating animals to a lower or dangerous status as well. So if we say, you know, we've already, and we see that with African Americans mm-hmm. throughout, when we're compared with animals, which we always are, mm-hmm. Then that also means that human beings, or white people, I should say, are equating animals as less than as well. And we know that when we're thinking about nature mm-hmm. and environment, one of the important things, one of the reasons I'm vegetarian, well, the reason I'm vegetarian mm-hmm. is about animal rights, right? Mm-hmm. This idea that we can't really put one sort of species above another. Mm-hmm. And when we can do that to people as well. I don't think that poets are any sort of, like, you know, Plato would say, any sort of higher being. Mm-hmm. But I think that a poet has to, there's a responsibility of the poet, in my mind, to see what's literally there and then make people dig deeper. Mm-hmm.
So then the poet has a different vision.
A different vision, or, what did I say, different vision? Second Sight.
Second Sight.
Yeah, Second Sight. Du Bois just jumped into my mind in that moment. But yeah, I think kind of a Second Sight. Like I think it's the poet's job to look again, and to look again after that, and to look again after that. There's a way that the poet has to take in the world, chew it up, and then put it back out there as medicine. I always use the example of poison and medicine. You know, like how we can make. I think poet's job is to make medicine out of the difficult stuff. My next book is sort of making medicine out of police brutality in a weird sort of way. So.
And so, can you talk about that? Yeah. That book now that you're working on.
I definitely can.
To current events.
Yes, definitely. I want to read two quotes though that I think are going to lead into it because I think they're really important. Please Ben Lerner, right, is a person who talks about like horrible poetry. What's horrible poetry, right? And he says there's an interesting quote that he says. I think there are a lot of good and great poems that manage to do what they want to do. But part of the persistent sense that poems are always failing to live up to the expectation of the historical moment has to do with how poetry less denotes a stable set of practices than it does a set of impossible demands. He says that the main demand associated with lyric poetry is that an individual poet can or must produce both a song that's irreducibly individual and that it's expression of their specific humanity, and that it also is shareable by everyone, because it can be intelligible to all social persons, so it can unite a community in its difference. And that demand, I think, is impossible, he says. It wants a poem to do something that only a revolution could do, to eradicate different kinds of inequality and social differences and violence. A lot of great poetry gets written because it wanders away from that pressure in some strategic way. And I would argue very differently. And I think that's a lot about seeing, right? I think not only does the poet have to have a second sight, but I think that there are poets who have different kinds of second sight. James Baldwin, one of my favorites, goes into this differently. I like to believe that poetry can create revolution. And we know that. I mean, that's why poets are often exiled or executed, right?
Yeah, you're right.
So Baldwin basically says the role of the artist is exactly the same role, I think, as the role of the lover. If you love somebody, you honor at least two necessities at once. One of them is to recognize something very dangerous or very difficult. And I think that's that lens of dealing with difficult work, which I think I'm trying to do in this book that's coming out. And basically he says, in any case, if you do love somebody, you honor that necessity endlessly. And being at the mercy of that love, you try to correct the person whom you love. Now, that's a two-way street. You've also got to be corrected. As I said, the people produce the artist, and it's true. The artist also produces the people. So Baldwin's talking about this exchange between community and poet that is very necessary. And he's talking about love being something that is revolutionary because it's making us look at hard things. I mean, and that's how revolution starts. We're looking at something that's not working for a large group of people. And he's arguing that it's our job as artists to force people to look at it, right? Very different than what, and Lerner is saying that's impossible. But I think for people of color and people that have been on the margins, people of color, women, they know that, or we know that that's something that we have to do and that it's not impossible because we have the eyes to see it. And so this book is, the book Ligatures is asking a lot of questions. The construct of the book is the idea, there was a prosecuting attorney in the Tamir Rice case after he chose not to convict. I think it was McGinty is the prosecuting attorney in that case. And he chose not to convict or even to bring the police up on charges. And so he said, though, that there's one good thing that will come out of this, and that's that he'll make sure that there are police cams and body cams, so dash cams and body cams for all police officers. And for me, what that did was, we know that we have 30 minutes of what happened to Tamir Rice on video, and still they chose not to convict. So what that does for me, and what prompted this book, is that African Americans have always had to see themselves dying on tape. The book is only about the people up to that point, up to last December or early January, that had been recorded, whether it's from body cams or dash cams or people's phones, that we saw die on tape, right? And so what it does then to me is it serves to make Black people stand in fear. It's like the lynching postcards that went across the country during lynching. I mean, they were to make Black people afraid and to assert white people's power.
And that's recent activities at Penn.
Yes, and recent, exactly. Yeah. And recent activities at Penn And seeing those things and hearing him say that was really sort of a slap in the face. And that's about that lens again. He didn't see that as probably as a negative thing. He thought, oh, good, this is going to be good for people. But it's not good for us to see ourselves dying on tape. And it's not good for many reasons. But one of them is it shows us that we're disposable because you're still not convicting. And then you're saying more tape will be good when you're not convicting when you have tape, right?
You just have the evidence. Yeah. Now, when you and you talk about this second vision.
Yes.
But also, I mean, you're also saying that the poet likely has a completely different reality. An experience is a completely different reality. How do you bridge the gap? You know, if you have such, whether it's a second vision or a different reality,
yes.
How do you cross the divide to those, to others who don't have that reality or who can't see what you
Absolutely.
Can see?
Absolutely. So one of the things I do is I tell true stories. I bring them, instead of writing about racism as a, so I'm giving them real people to connect to an abstract idea. Racism is something that's so hard for people in this country to deal with and to believe and to wrestle with. And so I give them Tamir Rice's true story. And I also give them in the book, not just Tamir Rice's story, but I give them the officer Lohman who shot him. I give them his story and his training and some understanding of why he might have done the thing he did, why it would have been so quick, such a quick reaction. And so that means I'm not telling people to blame Lohman. I'm saying, let's look at a system that's, I call it an American values education that we've been taught to judge people based on race and to value people based on race since the beginning of our country, because they've been taught to be afraid. And so that's what I'm talking about. Like, I think that as a poet, my job is to bring these sort of abstract or general things down to real people, down to real places, down to real emotion. And that's how the history piece comes in for me. That's how primary sources come in for me.
That gives a completely different meaning to the primary source.
And then people have to ask why of the sources now. They don't take them at face value. My poems are asking why of the sources. Exactly. And so I'm hoping that they'll also ask why of the sources and my poems.
And you're not making just an argument from the sources. No. You know, you're making an emotional connection in a way that a historical argument cannot make.
Yeah, I think that, so that's interesting. I think it can make it, but I think what it does, it can make
there's
that
a,
argument.
There's a separation.
There's a separation. Yeah. And also, I think I just really worship historians. I think that that work is amazing. The way that I might talk about slavery, for example, in my poems, the way I might be talking about it and the way the historian might be talking about it, they're the same sort of conversation, but mine becomes more accessible, I think, in part one, because of the way that I write. The only formal poetry or the form poetry that comes into my book, Core, is really used as the third poem in a conversation between two people. Because I think that it's already difficult sometimes. I'm having people who don't really talk to each other have conversations in my book. And so the only way that they can talk to each other is to have some boundaries or limits. And that's what form does. I really don't know if I'm doing anything different than they're doing. I mean, everybody's trying to tell a story. Of the past.
So, Denise, would you mind reading a poem from Ligatures?
One of the most difficult things about the book was trying to figure out how to get the African Americans who were killed to speak, because they didn't know that they had to speak for themselves. I mean, you know, they didn't know they were going to be killed, so it's pretty as simple as that. So they didn't know that they would have to tell their own stories or define who they were in contrast to who larger society says that they were in order to justify the killing of them. And so what I did was the only way that I could figure out how to give them a voice is to look at their autopsy reports. So in the chapbook version, which is coming out this weekend through Rattle Press, these autopsies aren't in there and this poem is not in there, but it's in the larger collection. And it's called Imagine a Love Song, and it's for and from Sandra Bland. And a lot of what's in this is actually from the autopsy. So, imagine I am not fingernail scrapings. Imagine I am not neck or vagina or legs. Imagine I am not a knot. Imagine you are not a toe tag, not rubber band that encircles the right wrist, not a black hooded zip-up sweatshirt cut, black, not black, with white lettering, blue jeans, black boxers, cut, two black shoes and two black socks. Imagine you are not toe tags attached to both great toes, ankles tied together, a boy altered by surgical intervention. Imagine you are not a recovered bullet, metal jacketed, moderately deformed, mushrooming at the nose, now TR inscribed on its base. Imagine instead, we are not kidney or head or hands. Imagine we are not unremarkable, not skin as thin or disposable or ordinary as a plastic garbage bag. Imagine us not on display, not pathology or pathologized. Imagine we, backs still vertical, still alive, not twisted until made lethal.
Thank you, Denise, and thank you to everyone for listening. You can find more on our blog at pastispresent.org. You can also download the podcast on the blog or on iTunes. I'm Ashley Cataldo. Our theme song is History Explains Itself by Josh Spacek. And stay tuned for more episodes from Past is Present.